Okay, tonight we're dealing with a very sensitive and challenging topic. So sensitive and so topic, there have been, you may have noticed, there have actually been protests in many in all the major cities of America, as well in even small towns. This is something that is literally currently dividing America. The issue of, the issues of systemic racism, white privilege, Black Lives Matter, and even to the degree that images of famous Americans who, whether George Washington, Grant, even Lincoln, people who have been venerated in our country, they're, literally attempts and success to take these statues down because either A, they own slaves, or B, as people of their time had, which we would call in our time, racist views. So it's a hot topic, and obviously it's not a class, it's a course, but I want to get into it because, and one thing that we had a class in the senior fellowship, not everybody's in the senior fellowship in this call, last we dealt with the analyzing the issue of the murder of Rayshard Brooks in Atlanta, who was shot, and we dealt with that from a perspective of what is the terrorist attitude toward the judicial system and as well as the police enforcement and how to deal with these issues of police brutality. And one of the things that made the class, I think, very fantastic was we have amongst our own, current fellows, senior fellows, past fellows, we have all of you people on the call are very, I've learned with all of you over the years, and all of you are very bright. All of you have great insight. And some people even have done this professionally. Simone's on the call. She actually, her profession, she's a journalist and deal with federal law enforcement, local policing, issues of brutal brutality. We have Daffy in the call. She works for a judge in New York City, dealing with the issues of lawsuits against New York City. We got Suzanne, who was a parole officer. So we have, and we have Raquel, who's an attorney. I got Adrian, who's an attorney. We're Jews. We got a lot of attorneys. So it's an area of justice and issues of the issue of racism. We live and work in America. We live in a multicultural society, and these issues are complex and are challenging. In a certain sense, a little bit weird because these issues are coming up, and many of us have not been in our office for 3 or 4 months. We work, of course, collaboratively. Hopefully, some of us do, via Zoom, phone, etc. But the full, when God willing, COVID passes or is mitigated, these issues I think are going to become more acute because there are more changes happening. This is we're on the edge of, I think, systemic change in America. So I want to get into it, and I want to get into from the way that I like to get into these issues is from a personal standpoint. So as many of you know, I used before MJE, I was a yeshiva high school principal in Long Island. It was a Torah Academy of Suffolk County, and we were in Commack, Long Island. Okay? 9th through 12th, then we extend down to 7th through 12th. And many of you have had the Rabbi Yoni Sachs has taught you, many of you. He taught in the first year of the fellowship. He was a Rambam. So many of you know him. So he was also a teacher with me. This is going back, early 2000s, okay? So we had, as a good Jew, modern Orthodox yeshiva high school, we had, Judaic studies in the morning, and we had general studies, and with APs, with all the fixings. And of course, we had an AP, we had a mock trial. I, in fact, was, at one point, the mock trial advisor. We actually had we hired our own mock trial. We got a lawyer from the Association of Mock Trial, from the Bar Association, and we would play various high schools in Long Island. Okay? So the story is like this. 1 year, we're going to compete against Wynadanch High School, okay? From Comac, I don't know, 7 miles away, 8 miles away, very not that far away. But it's an extremely poor, depressed school district. Mostly people of color attend that 2,000-member high school. Rabbi Sachs walks into the building with the students. He went there because he was nervous for the students' safety, okay? So imagine you got these day school kids who are all prepped, ready to do the mock trial event, walking into Wynadanch High School, okay? And the walk in there, and you're like walking into a different zone. Windows are broken. The roof is leaking. And they go into a room, and the other team doesn't have a mock trial coach. The kids themselves are trying to train themselves to do it. It comes out in the conversation that not all the kids have all the books for all the classes. So they're taking classes. And as I'm going to show a short video, you'll just see how impoverished this school district is. So I'm going to go back to Rabbi Sachs' reaction to my conversation with him since. So I just want to give you guys a little flavor, because Amir, like so many school districts in America, you have Wynadanch, and then the school that our very own Raquel Reinstein attended in Dix Hills, New York, 5 miles up the road, is one of the finest and well-funded public schools in Long Island. So let's go, as they say, let us go to the videotape. Okay, I'm doing the old share screen. And here we go.
Season at Wynadanch Memorial High School. This year, the school is weighing the impact of Governor Patterson's proposed $1.1 billion statewide education cuts.
We're looking at cutting a lot of teachers, and it's going to have a great impact on the students because we don't have all the teachers that we need currently.
The school cut staff, electives, and even some sports teams to try to balance its books last year. This year brings more bad news.
We have only one AP class right in Wynadanch right now. We may have to cut that one AP class.
Memorial High must also pay to fix its leaky roof and solve the academic woes that led to last year's 55% graduation rate. On top of that, the school and its district spent the last 2 years in a $3 million hole. The budget cuts would swell the deficit to $4 million, meaning tougher decisions for the superintendent.
You're always looking to see how you can make a budget that is going to meet the needs of your student population, but at the same token, you can't break the backs of the homeowners. So that's a juggling act.
But Memorial High is not the only school being hit with budget cuts. Schools all over Long Island will have to deal with less state funding. In fact, you don't have to travel far to get a closer look at one of them. Take a 10-minute cab ride to 375 Wolf Hill Road, and you're at Half Hollows Hills West High School, located only 7 miles away from Wynadanch Memorial High, but figuratively, worlds apart. Hills West is a staple on the state's list of quality schools.
Yeah, I think this school really did help me get into like a good college.
But it is also trying to cope with less aid. The school cut sports teams, electives, and transportation to stay financially stable. It even sent out an invitation to Governor Patterson.
We wanted the governor to see firsthand what a good district does on all facets, and tell him that the cuts in state aid, you will diminish that program.
All right, you get the basic sense there. So let me ask a couple of questions over here.
Though both schools will be.
Hold on a second. So let's get to some questions here. So I'll start off with an easy question. Just throwing this out here, guys. In what district will a student have a better shot of getting a better college, getting into a better college and a better job? Wynadanch High School or Half Hollow Hills West High School?
Hi, so as someone who actually attended Hills East,
yes.
Not Hills West, but same district.
Yes.
I want to say that it's not as clear as you think. So it's very easy to assume the quick answer, And that's not, well, obviously Wyandanch doesn't offer a lot of classes, but bear in mind, what's interesting is that there's some level of busing integration, at least there was when I was in high school. So there were some children from Wyandanch who were actually bused to Half Hollow Hills.
Right.
And so then the question is, what sort of education did they get at Half Hollow Hills? So unfortunately, the fact of the matter is it was mostly oil and water. That's what I always considered it when I was in high school. What does that mean? There were the honors and AP students. There were the regent students. And then there were the non-regent students. And frankly speaking, you were bussed in. And like, there was one woman who was African-American in my AP classes. We got a 1600 SAT. She ended up getting admitted to the BAMD program at Brown. And I checked, and she's, you know, very successful in life, as she should be. She was brilliant. That was largely the exception. I'm being perfectly honest.
Right. Okay. Raquel, but that you're dealing with a number of outliers. When you're talking about Wyandanch, where only 55% of the students actually graduate, when they don't even offer an AP, versus Half Hollow Hills has 10 APs, it's pretty. I mean, that was a softball lob.
No. I'm saying that there were a lot of students from the area bused to Half Hollow Hills because there was busing. Like, they literally, they
correct.
Like, at some point in the 80s or 90s or 70s, I don't know when, they decided, you know what, this is unfair, so we're just going to do busing. And that's the way to address the inequity.
Okay.
So what I'm saying is that while they physically resided in the same building as those other students who had all these AP classes offered, most did not actually get the benefit.
Right, correct. That's also true.
Of honors and AP classes, even residing in the same building. So that's another issue, too.
Correct. Anybody else? Okay, so I'll ask another question. That was the warm-up law, but let me get a little more spicier. You know, so here's a question. Is funding school districts via property taxes a fundamental example of systemic racism?
Hi.
Oh.
Hi.
Okay, so...
I think it depends on what you mean by systemic racism.
Go ahead.
Because some people define a racist policy as one that has a disproportionate negative effect on people of color, but then some people frame it in terms of, well, it's not just a matter of a disproportionate effect, it's also a matter of what the intent is. So I think it depends on if you see it in terms of intent, or if you're willing to say something's racist just based on the impact.
Well, I have to say, like, to what John's point, like, it's all impact. There's no law on the American books today that you'll find is like, that will say, okay, people of this skin color can't do XYZ. I mean, there's no substantive law like that today. It's all about impact. And the Supreme Court even has a term for it. Like, I forgot. It was the Chinese laundry case where, like, in San Francisco, they said if you were a laundromat and, like, you couldn't be housed in a wooden building, that affected only Chinese people. And the Supreme Court, like, saw through that, and they said, no, you can't have a law on the books just because it, like, doesn't say Chinese people. We know it's going to affect only Chinese people. So,
like, can I jump in? Sorry to cut
yeah,
off.
Yeah, it is systemic, but yeah,
wait,
it is systemic.
Can I answer the question? Because what the rabbi's alluding to is the history of redlining. So, yes, is it systemic racism today? Because there's no law on the books today, but it's those on the call who are lawyers. We all know the history of the Fair Housing Act in the federal government. Levittown, the first American suburb, did not allow blacks. And how did they do that? By not letting them have mortgages. So
right.
The problem when you start taxing homeowners to pay for school districts is, number one, a lot of wealthy American suburbs, only until the 60s and 70s, like, banks wouldn't even allow blacks to move in there because they wouldn't literally give them loans. So that is the legacy of it. So, yes, on paper today in 2020, we don't have a law. But do you have a history of segregation through banks? Like, we're not the South or the Northeast. We do this through finances. Yes. And that history still lives today. And you have now in suburban towns a lot of housing projects. If you go to Mount Vernon in Westchester, compare Mount Vernon, which is black and poor, to Scarsdale, which is rich and Jewish, right? Why do those two communities look so vastly different? Look into the history of redlining.
So I want to jump in there. All right, so good. So just I want
to take into
all right, all right, guys. Guys, this is a massive topic, and we don't have all night long. So let me just I'm gonna take control. I'm taking the wheel, guys. So here's the point. So on average, if you are, in other words, if you take the premise as it is in the United States that you have an obligation that all students of K through 12 or first through 12 should get a education. But how the money is not there is the money. How are public schools funded? Their public schools are funded locally, so it's very simple. So if you're in Dix Hills and the average household income is $175,000 a year, and they're paying about $15,000 to $20,000 per household for a school, for the public schools. So therefore, surprise. You're getting a student who is receiving, an education which is like equivalent of $25,000, $30,000, equivalent to a private school. If you happen to live in the Hamptons, I looked this up. If you go to the best one in Long Island is Fire Island. If you're a non-Jew, you want to live in Fire Island because they spend $47,000 per child in their public school. Why? Because they have megatudinal houses. In fact, the people who pay the taxes don't usually live there because that's usually their second house. So there's a fundamental inequality in the way that we fund the public school. So if you are in the poor neighborhood, like Wynandanch, you're in the average income of a family is like $70,000. So there's a limit to how much they can tax their homeowners. So therefore, the people in that the schools are going to be impoverished by definition. They don't got the money. Now, why is that a fair way to provide equal education? When, if you are white and middle class or middle class, you're going to be in the nicer neighborhoods and the well-funded districts. If you're not, you're screwed. Is that open racism? You know, so it becomes becomes a nuanced phenomenon. But clearly, that's a big disadvantage. I'm going to go to Brian Hacken in New York.
Here I am.
There you go.
Broadcasting live from Brooklyn, Midwood, Flatbush area.
All right.
I think what you bring up is a really interesting point, but at the same time, listen, I went to New York City public school. My parents were both public school teachers. And, when you have a job and you have kids and you're making money and you see how you want to spend it and where you're going to buy a house, education is going to be part of that decision. And people are fortunate enough to live in nice neighborhoods and pay very high taxes and have a good public school. One of my friends who grew up around the corner from me does extremely well for himself, and he ended up moving out to New Jersey, and one of his reasons was, I want to live in a neighborhood where my kids could be surrounded by affluent people to a certain extent, and that's really going to set their trajectory on where they go. Even if you want to, forgetting about school, if you want to just talk about Jewish day camp, a Jewish sleepaway camp, I mean, everybody's getting an internship, everybody's getting a job from a friend, a counselor, somebody's father, and it's just really separating classes that way. And it's just a matter of which path you want to take. And if you want to talk about public school versus private school, you could talk about people that live in the five towns. You can live in one block where it's $10,000 and you go to this school, or you could live two blocks over and be paying $18,000, $20,000, $25,000 in taxes and not be going to school.
Right.
You're paying those taxes to send your kid to a Jewish day school, which is going to be running you $20,000. So what am I paying those taxes to send my and not reap the benefits of?
Correct, correct. So these are, we're not, by the way, guys, we're not solving this problem tonight. FYI, we're not solving it. But I want...
What?
Right. We're not solving the problem. And the truth is, Brian, your friend is correct. If you want to financially get ahead in life, networking is a major factor. Networking does not start when you're in jobs. People go into business who they meet in college. In other words, the benefit for going to the Ivy Leagues is not necessarily the great education, but you're with the most, and I'm going to use the word, privileged people who are basically going to be in a great situation. So forget about solving the problems or the injustices in America, which are many. Clearly, if you want to get ahead, you know, you got to be in it to win it. And being where people are successful is the way to go. So your friend is, from a financial standpoint, he's 10,000% correct. Factually, there's no deny about that. You know what I mean?
So he's one example who is lucky enough to be very wealthy and to put himself in that situation.
Yep.
I have another friend who isn't in that type of scenario, but what he sees is that being in this type of area will be beneficial to his children. So, I mean, he's trying to make both ends meet in order to line his child up for success in that way.
There's nothing wrong with you want your children to be successful. The question is, the way has America arranged its policies of funding education, a function of systemic racism. And the fact is that it works out that if you're in the wealthy communities, you're going to get the way better education. In fact, to deal with this inequality, the states pay what they call a Title I aid to try to, you know, to bridge the gaps. So this is a massive topic.
I think that's what you're touching on, something that's very important, though,
yeah,
is the fact that in the United States, we are one of the only countries that structures our funding of our school system that way, right?
Correct.
So if you're touching on the point that there, you know, is a history of, like, you know, not wanting to pay for other people's school and wanting to only, like, fund your own.
Right.
So other countries don't structure it that way, and that's why there's more equal education in other countries.
Correct. All right, so this is a massive thing now. I'm going to switch gears here, guys, because I want to keep it moving.
Wait, sorry, can I just ask, like,
Rebecca Goldenberg? All right, welcome, Rebecca.
So we kind of have made it seem that it's just like everything's based on zip code, but doesn't government take some accountability, right? So, like, how you fund these schools, but how you manage the funds?
That's also true.
Some of these schools are completely mismanaged.
Yes.
Some of these local governments are completely mismanaged.
Yes.
Plus, the teachers' unions aren't... I mean, there are so many issues with the teachers' unions, which is why you have charter schools, you have school choice, you have magnet schools, you have all these other options, because there are flaws inherent in the system that are not just about the zip code. I'm not saying the zip code isn't an issue. I'm just saying that there are other issues, too, that you can't overlook.
So Rebecca's correct. Ironically, here's the wild thing. In my research, it works out with the state aid, Wynadanch actually spends more money than Half Hollow Hills, at least, you know, it used to 10 years ago. Not true anymore. But they were so poorly managed. But you can still argue it's still a case of systemic racism, because why are you giving the local people who are having a track record of mismanagement, why should it be left to every local community to try to manage their budget and their thing? That itself is a little crazy. Other communities don't do that. So, and again, how to pull out the racism from that, not so simple. So,
but mismanagement is also a voting issue. So it's who you vote in office at the top and at all the levels. And that's a community issue.
Correct.
You have a choice of who to vote, and you have a choice to say that if you've mismanaged the school system for the past 4 years or the past 2 years or however long you've been ahead of the Board of Ed or mayor or selectman or whatever, you can vote them out. That's the beauty of this country.
Correct. But yet we have to deal with the reality is that the poor districts, and it's not just, you know, people of color, but they tend to correlate with that, on average are $2,200 on average are paid for less in those districts. Now, the issue of management is a very important issue. Unions are big issues, again, complex issue. Now, I want to pivot because we already used up. We're going to go to.
I'm sorry. I just have.
Oh, Raquel, I can't. I'm not going to get to the class. I know we can talk all night, but I do want to end at 9:15 or earlier. So I'm gonna pivot here to get a little closer to what's happening on the streets of America. Okay, that's our topic here. Now, this past summer, Simone told me something, or this past year said, "Rabbi, you're woke." I'll be honest with all of you, I didn't know what she was talking about. I had to go online and look up, Simone's on the call with us, so I'm being honest here, I had to look up what that meant. I don't know, but as a 53-year-old white rabbi, that is not part of my language. So, but I did find out, and I was moved by that. I'm not sure it's true, but I took the compliment anyways. So you two, we're going to get a little bit of the education, a perspective here. And I want to use this, because again, this is officially a Parsha class. We're going to use this to understand one of the more challenging and mysterious elements of the Torah, the idea of chukim, the laws that seemingly have no reason. So we're going to, that's where we're headed. Let's go to another video if we can. Here we go. All right, we do the share screen. And here we go.
What's my name? Topic to y'all. And I'm talking to y'all about one of my favorite topics that's really close to my heart, and that's awake, woke, work. Y'all heard these terms? Yeah, you hear them all the time. It seems to become a trend for people to say, I'm woke, hashtag woke, etc., but not really understand what that means, because some of y'all, as I always say, walking around here awake, but y'all ain't woke. So let's differentiate what that means, so that you can get there, right? Because it's a progression. It's about being awake, then you woke up, and now you are working. Okay? So, what does it mean to be awake? Awake is when you believe in diversity, equity, and inclusion. You believe that it's a good thing. You believe that representation matters. And if there's a DEI event, you might show up and support, right? But that's the only action you take. That doesn't make you woke. That makes you awake. It means you started to open your eyes to the fact that diversity matters, inclusion matters, and equity matters. But you leave it up to, for example, in a company, your HR department, and you say, okay, but that's your thing. You go solve the issue of diversity, equity, and inclusion. I just believe it, but I'm going to support you from a distance. Those are the people that are awake. Ask yourself, where are you on that spectrum? Now, awoke or woke means that you are doing some sort of action. You have started to work to believe that diversity, equity, and inclusion is important. You've started to reassess policies. You are thinking about what does it take to do diversity, equity, and inclusion. You might be seeking out solutions, etc. And let me pause and give a shout out to Equity in the Center's framework for achieving racial equity, because we are using their lens when we're describing what it means to be awake, woke, and work, and I feel that it's important to give credit where it's due. So thank y'all for producing that framework, because it has informed our learning series. Now, also to be awoke means that you have started to have conversations that contribute to your own personal journey of impacting someone's culture. So to be awoke means you're like, okay, I want to make a difference, but I know I need to start with me. So you have started to progress within that journey of self-awareness and action. Right? So you might be having panels. You might be speaking on panels. You have done the research. You are gaining the knowledge to actually learn about what it takes to make diversity, equity, and inclusion sustainable within a company. You are actually moving towards work. But first, you are woke to the point where you are working on yourself. Now, the implication for awake, woke, and work is different. The context of work means that you are actually out there impacting policy. You have started to create some sort of guidelines, etc., and you are in the thick of it, doing the action. You are working towards change. You started to work with leaders to do talent development and recruitment of diverse populations. You are running assessments in your organization to create long-term sustainability and change. You're working. So this is what it's like when you're on that spectrum, right? From going to being awake, you won't wake up and get that crust and that dirt out of your eye, and you know that there's a problem with DEI, and you acknowledge that the issue exists, but you're still uncomfortable with addressing it. And then you slowly but surely make progress to get to being woke. And when you are woke, remember it's about self-reflection, identifying where you might be contributing to someone's oppression in some way, shape, or form, or how your privilege exists, or you might even be looking at your own oppression and how those manifest, right? It's about that level of consciousness to start to understand why systems and structural inequalities exist. And once you build that understanding, then you slowly but surely navigate to a place where you are doing the work. You are modeling the responsibility of diversity, equity, and inclusion in some way, shape, or form. So whether that's through talent development, whether that is through vetting different vendors, or you're creating policies and practices within your organization that impact structural inequality in some way, shape, or form, you are putting yourself out there and doing that work.
Okay. All right. All right.
Does that make sense?
All right, so that was that. All right, so we have a number of questions on this. All right, so just I'm not sure everybody heard this. According to this paradigm, when is a person awake using their paradigm? Who would like to chime in? Everybody so...
When they realize the inequality around them?
Yes. In other words, there becomes a sensitivity that, in fact, we do not live in a fully just society, and there is inequality. But what does the person not do, even though he's awake?
They don't do anything about it.
They don't do anything about it. In other words, I support, as the professional on the thing says, she said, you support from afar. That's HR's job. I noticed that everybody here is all white. They should allow people who are also non-white who are capable to be part of this company. It's not my job. Not my job. Okay, what's the definition of woke? What's their definition of woke using this paradigm?
When you're doing some panel, some talk, some research, you're doing something about it. And you're doing yourself, also you're part of the change.
Excellent, Jenna. Where you are yourself doing research about these issues, you are reflecting on your own perspectives, questioning your own attitudes, and considering where these issues are manifest in our world, in your own world. That's a definition of woke. When you're now aware of these issues to the degree that you are becoming conversant, you are assessing yourself, like, hey, do I have certain implicit advantages? Do I have them as a white male who went to Columbia University? The answer is no. No, just joking. Okay, so
Rabbi Kenny, is it sort of like a cheshbon nefesh
aware.
Like, it works on two levels. Like, it's your own personal, like, accounting. Was I right today? Did I treat people well? Did I take into account XYZ when this happened today?
Yes.
And then it's, like, every day. Like, okay, I have to be aware. I live in this city. I make this income. And I live in this building. And things are not just the way they are because they are. Because there is a history to this country that has a lot of systemic racisms in place. And it's just to be aware of that and how that affects. So it, like, works twofold, in a personal level and in an objective level.
Correct, Daphne. And now, last one, what is the definition of what the woman called doing the work? What is the call doing the work?
I mean, it could be as simple as, like, reading a book just to, like...
No, that's not doing the work. That's, according to her definition, that's still being woke.
It's
setting policy.
Right, trying to effectuate change.
That's why I called you woke. It's when you help us get a dean of Berkeley.
There you go.
Yeah. After Ruthie left.
That's it.
Your push, sir.
That's it. Okay. I hopefully I'm on the level to be woke. I'm not sure I'm going to give myself a pat on the back, but I'll take it. Anyway, so that's those are three things. We have awake, where you're basically becoming aware that there are issues here, there are injustices in the world, there are problems in the world. But it's somebody else's problem. Woke is where you're realized to the degree that you are researching the issue, you're exploring the issue, becoming educated in the issue, and also looking your own self, as Daphne said, what they call a cheshbon nefesh, a self-analysis. Well, where does this imply, where does this happen in my life? I'm going to get to a practical personal story in a moment. And then work is actually seeing, trying to rectify this injustice, creating policy where it can be. Now, here's my question. Let's get a little more spicy. Do you think that the parents, and I'll include myself on this, at Half Hollow Hills are asleep, fake woke, which we did not define yet, awake, woke, or doing the work? Those are your choices.
Well, let me just say this. It's not an undiverse school district. That's what I was trying to say. It is in the sense of the honors and the AP classes, but not in the sense of, like, literally the graduates. There were substantial...
How about the, I'm not talking about the students that are bussed in from the other districts. I'm talking about the parents who live in Dix Hills, where the combined salary is an average of $175,000 a year. Would you guess, on average, again, we don't know, we can't go into their souls, would you put them as asleep, fake woke, awake, woke, or doing the work, and why?
I would say if they got their kids the bus into the other school district, they were working on it.
They may have not had a choice on that. They may have been a state, and I don't know. But all right, so for I don't know.
It's hard. I don't know that school district, but like there is a certain aspect. Like, again, if you take the five towns which was mentioned, right, where you have the public schools and you have people moving out of the Rockaways into Inwood to get that education with the five towns' white Jewish population.
Yes.
And WASP population, quote unquote, that used to be out there also, and there was a certain aspect of. You'd have people at the meetings, at the PTA meetings and the district meetings, but they got up there, they spoke, but many times they weren't heard, or they were just, you know, they were heard if it was for the sports teams or the other benefits that would help the white kids go to the Ivy League schools.
There you go. So let me just speak. So I can't go into the souls of the people of Half Hollow Hills. Let me just go to you as a principal in Commack, Long Island, dealing with middle class, upper middle class Jews. Was I aware that there were districts in... I had a school where all the... Well, I had five AP courses. Kids had Judaic studies. We had, clubs. We had the sports. We had the, yeshiva high schools. You know, Baruch Hashem. We're doing all right. So was I aware that there were other districts that didn't have? Yes. How long did I think about that for? About 2 seconds. Now, let me go, and I'll speak about myself, and I think that also applies to many other. Why? Because that problem is, as we discuss, as we start to unpack a little bit, is enormous. And I got my own problems. I'm trying to lead my own life, and I'm trying to educate the school and lead the teachers and lead the program. I don't got to, how am I going to solve that? And two, it makes me feel guilty. It makes me feel bad. Do I want to feel guilty? Do I want to feel bad? I don't want to feel guilty, and I don't want to feel bad. So what do? You push it out of your mind. It goes away.
But Penny, on the other hand, there was a certain recognition in the way, I don't know exactly the history of BOCES in Long Island, but that BOCES by Nassau Community College, I mean, all the kids, it's like a technical school, so all the kids that couldn't, even the woodworking and all the extracurriculars or film production, whoever couldn't do a basic curriculum at the school level, right, there was honors, regents, in school, they supplemented, they sent them to BOCES to learn trades.
I'm not here to indict to say that there's no good going on in American public schools. That's also not true.
I'm not sticking up to the five towns either. I'm just saying I don't know what Suffolk County has, but do they have something like that?
Of course it has BOCES. Yes. So the bottom line is that I'm going to assume that I and the other middle class or upper middle class white residents of Long Island were like me, mostly like me, basically asleep. Or nowadays, if I go on my Facebook, I'll see a lot of, what's fake woke? Who can tell me what fake woke is?
I think most people are fake woke because it's a trend. It's like the thing.
Give me examples of fake woke behavior. Come on, guys.
Like, corporations like doing Blackout Tuesday, like Amazon, saying that they'll do more. A lot of people look at it like a trend.
here's the thing. A hashtag in this day and age is not a movement. Action is movement.
Okay, right. So a person who says, like, you know, claims that they're they'll say hashtag Black Lives Matter. They'll say things, you know, that are perceived as being virtuous in the community now. But reality, they might still be living a very much, a privileged white existence, and really indifferent to the plight of anybody who is a people of color or anything at all. And see, what are you talking about? There's no slavery. What do you mean? But they'll just do a few things. All right, they'll vote to, let's have Teddy Roosevelt removed and the black guy looking up at him. All right, what they call in Yiddish, Yoytze Zayin. All right, you happy now? I want to live my life. You're bothering me. I want to walk down the street. I don't want any darn parades, protests. I certainly don't want any riots. We got to get this work back to business. And we'll throw a few gestures your way that we recognize that there's an issue. But it's not really, you know, how authentic is it? Now, there's certain people that are looking to the area. Now, by the way, I'm not here endorsing any issues. Any movements, you know, many people say, like, you know, Black Lives Matter as an organization is tied to the BDS movement, which is problematic. But you can also maintain that I support the police. I don't support, police brutality. I don't believe they should be defunded because I don't think that's going to help anything. I think that there can be expressions of systemic racism. I don't have a solution because that's a little bit above my pay grade. But so fake woke is trying to say that you're this really authentic and just person who's trying to make a difference, but in reality it's really, you know, really a part of your posturing and cultivating your brand on your social media brand. And basically it's superficial and baloney. That's fake woke. So we continue. So let me get to the Torah part of this, if I may. What mitzvah do we violate if we are asleep to the problem of injustice of systemic racism? If, in fact, we can agree for a moment that there is examples of systemic racism in America, for example, I'll give you another simple example of systemic racism, is that I had a classmate at Columbia University, went to Teachers College, a black man. He get pulled over for a speeding violation. The guy's petrified. I get pulled over. I've gotten a speeding ticket, you know, full disclosure. You know what I mean? I'm zipping up the 87 turnpike. I get pulled over, okay? I'm nervous, but I don't think I'm worried that I'm going to get yanked out and beaten up. I view it as a low probability. You know, I'll just say, officer, good evening. And here's my license and registration. I oftentimes, and it might be white privilege, I can't prove it either way. It's hard to know. I'll get off because, I look like a nice guy. I don't know. I have shame upon him. I don't know. They'll just give it back to me. My old colleague who was in Teachers College, we're on the same level of education, he gets pulled over. Dude's petrified that he's going to be victimized. Now, is he, maybe he's crazy? No, I don't think he's crazy. I think that is an expression of that there is a bias. Can I prove it? Am I a sociologist? As am I a criminologist? No. But I'm saying that that's a possibility. Okay. So what mitzvah does America violate, do as an individual violate if they're involved in systemic racism or racism in any, of any kind? Let's say you own a business and you don't hire somebody because they're black. What
is it,
Torah mitzvah have you violated?
Is it
Lotamon al dam reyecha, don't stand on your neighbor's blood, is that you see the person drowning and you don't help them. You see a person suffering, you know, literally dying, and you don't help. So
I thought that we're all created in God's image.
So that's a fact, right?
Oh.
So how's that? What? So if I don't hire the qualified person of color, because he's black or she's black, what did I violate? What mitzvah did I violate?
Well, you're not treating them in a way that you would be treating yourself. You're not being appropriate. You wouldn't want someone to do that to you, but you're doing it to them. So you're not.
Right. Shira is 100% correct. I'm being unjust. I would want, if I was qualified for the job, I would want to be hired, and I'm acting this person unjustly. I am disqualifying this person for no reason other than an accidental feature, a secondary feature. I'm not judging, as Martin Luther King said so beautifully, I'm not judging by the quality of their character, but of the color of their skin. And that's an act of injustice. And the Torah says, Tzedek Tirdof, you shall pursue justice. It's the most foundational, basic mitzvah of the Torah. A guy doesn't do that. That's like a major, that's a major issue. In order, you need two steps, as Esther's point. One, we judge a person based upon their soul. They're created in the image of God. They have a soul. They're both they're human, and therefore they have there's a kavod abriyot. There's a dignity that comes with that. And if I disqualify them based upon their color of the skin, that's an act of injustice. It's an act of injustice. So that's what's at play here. It's not a small thing. The whole Torah, half the Torah, is about laws of justice. Bein adam l'chaveru. All of you graduates of the fellowship, you know that. Mitzvah is bein adam l'chaveru. Mitzvah between yourself and your fellow. Okay? And that's enacting in a just fashion. Kavod abrios, dealing with all people with dignity. That's it. So if I don't hire somebody, because they're black, is an act of injustice and a Torah violation. That's it. Now, here's my question. Let's go into a little deeper here. At what point do sleeping people really understand systemic racism? When they are awake, when they're woke, or doing the work? When do they really understand systemic racism? When they are awake, when they're woke, or when they're doing the work?
Probably doing the work.
Why do you say that, Daphne?
Because then you really see how difficult it is to try and undo, so not undo, but address so much historical injustice. It's a lot of work. It's not like something that will go away in our generation.
Daphne, thank you for that optimistic forecast. All right, Daphne's saying a no can do on the reduction of systemic racism there. All right. I'm feeling positive. Come on, go team. All right.
I think it's a lot of work to do that if we start it now, maybe three generations, there'll be some kind of healing, because we forget, Jim Crow wasn't that long ago, and it's the effects are still felt today. Okay, that was history. It's such a fantasy, because you still see it today in America. My parents came here in 1973, okay? That's, I can say, okay, my parents came here in 1973, I don't have anything to do with this. That's BS. You're part of this country, you look a certain way, you benefit from things, from certain injustices that happened in the past, and it's a lot of work to fix that.
Correct. So I would agree with Daphne. In other words, just speaking for myself, when I'm just looking back at my own life, I mean, you can be what they call in the Jewish bubble, who most of the people are, most Jews are not Jews of color. 99.99 are white, Ashkenazic, typically middle class, upper middle class, white bread Ashkenazim. Look at me. That's what a white Ashkenazi guy looks like, okay?
It's Ashkenormative.
I'm the Ashkenormative, right?
Rabbi, it's 15%. It's the co-founder of Kobo.
Okay, hold on, Simone. Yeah, I stand corrected.
It's literally 15%.
Right, but in my...
I'm just letting you know. There's mixed kids like me. You have Mizrahi, Moroccan, Yemeni in America.
Correct. So fine.
You have diverse the Jews.
Correct. Now, see, look, I'm becoming... Simone, I'm becoming more Simone, I'm becoming more awake as it becomes. So I was not 99%. See, by the way, that shows my implicit racism. I look at the world in Ashkenazic views. Every Jew, except in Israel, every Jew is white. Not true.
Every Syrian, Sephardi, Persian, they don't count.
Right.
Yeah, what about us, the Barakets?
What about the Persians?
The Persians, all right. So I'm trying to articulate my lack of awokeness here. So 85%. But the way I project it, I'm 85%, we're living like this, like the white mafia over here. We're doing all right. Things are good. You're hanging out at the kiddush, schmoozing, cruising, a little bit of boozing. The world is great. I don't see any injustice. What's injustice? Pass the chant. So, because in my little bubble that I created, I don't see any injustice. I don't see any racism, really. Okay, because I don't want to see any. I don't want to see. So gets to the key point. Why is it impossible for the self-centered sleeper to conceive of justice? I'll say that question again.
They can't admit that they're part of injustice.
But because I don't want to admit to it. I don't want to see a world where I feel bad. So that's very easy. So what do I do?
Yeah, but you're Jewish. I mean, like, we should know.
But it's not so. But as you said before, these things are not so simple. These things are not so simple to recognize that there's any issue. And again, I'm not here to quote unquote poskin what level of racism or what the exact measurement is, and all these different questions, which I will let the academics argue upon. I'm just, I don't want now. The thing is like this. I want to now universalize this concept. Can a person be asleep about any other injustice or sin in other mitzvos beyond injustice?
All right, I have to go, kids. Bye.
Bye.
So, is there any other mitzvot or any other sins, chetayim, that I could be also asleep about?
Oh, yeah. How many people died in Syria in the last year? I mean, it's insane. The amount of it, it's overwhelming. Like you said, it's just too much, and people have their own day-to-day problems, and it's just so easy to turn TV on and not think about it.
True. So that's in the world. I'm saying, let's leave the world of injustice. Let's go to other issues, other areas of our Jewish life, any other areas that we're asleep about.
Sorry, so Rabbi, I have a question.
I
agree with you that right, we should not hire someone based on the color of their skin. That's not what I'm saying here. But
Rebecca, good to hear that. Rebecca, good to hear that.
No, okay. So but my question is, and maybe this is off topic, but what if you have an applicant who is perfectly qualified, knowledgeable in their Torah study, whatever it is that you're looking for, but you happen to know through other means that they're not, that their sexuality is not according to the Torah. If you don't hire them, is that considered, I guess, racist, just a form of discrimination? Because based on, you know, what we believe or what Orthodox Jews believe versus conservative versus Reform. I mean, right? And I think now that if you look at some Orthodox synagogues or conservadox or whatever, you do see different families that are not, quote-unquote, maybe what we grew up with or what used to be the norm or whatever. So where does that fit into all of this? Because I think that is, I think everything's changing, and I think we should be accepting, and I think it should be a wider tent.
So Rebecca, that's a juicy topic. So we're not going to take systemic injustice and sexual identity and homosexuality in Judaism. We can't do that in all one class because that's just a mega. We'd have to get comfortable for that one. That's a good topic. Maybe I'll take it up. Why not? Well, you know.
Sorry,
I'm better than Netflix. What are you talking about? We'll do it.
All Lives Mattering. So it's part of the All Lives Mattering topic.
Right, correct. So look, I'll just give you a short answer. Obviously, you know, that gets a little complicated because if they have to represent a Jewish ideal and a person is openly violating one of the myths of the Torah, being, married, involved in homosexual marriage, that could pose a problem. So that's a whole topic, but I want to give that proper justice. We're gonna put that on the side, and we'll take the issue of sexual orientation, gender, and other as another hot topic class. Can't do everything one night. I'm running out of time. We continue. Okay. So there are other areas. How about the most simple area? How about being healthy? Can I be asleep, fake woke? Awake, and doing the work when it comes to the gym.
Yeah, of course.
No, I wish you could just not do the work. If there was a way, I would have found it. No, you have to do the awful work.
No, but do we go through the same process?
Yeah, of course you do. You think just by joining a gym and having the membership, you're magically going to lose the weight.
Yes. Like forever.
Been there.
Die.
Right. In order, basically, not only that, the entire gym industry is based on the fact that people are going to be are truly asleep, possibly fake woke about what it really takes to become truly concerned about your health and well-being. Because, for example, little fact, for people who successfully lose weight, only 1% can do it on exercise alone. 1%. So really, the essence is not the gym. The gym will make you feel better. And I worked out today, full disclosure. But it's not going to, you're still going to have a gut. I got a gut. Because you got to be putting down the nachos. You got to commit to not taking a second hit of the chomp pot. If you're not doing that, I'm sorry.
So you can be
asleep. You can be maybe fake woke is the biggest thing. I have my, you know, people walk around with their keychain and they got the big, you know, their big gym membership. You know, I got New York Sports Club, which they don't even know. You know, they don't even know where it is. They haven't been there. It moves, but they never went to the new location. You know, but they're still paying $45 a month, $75 a month. But they're feeling very. I could go to gym anytime I want. All right, that's fake woke. Okay, so.
But there's also a difference between you going to the gym and you concerned over your health, and then having, let's say, me say, "Hey, Rabbi Penny, are you okay?" You know, like. There's a difference, because if you're saying neighbor to neighbor, friend to friend, student to student, you know, it's all these things. It's you're taking yourself into consideration, right? But the whole idea is you want me to think about you, or you hope that
that would be really sweet. That would be very sweet of you. I know one thing about Robin, you won't be mean about it. I said, are you sure you need that extra snack, Rabbi Rosenthal? The answer is no. So the bottom line is the area, the spectrum that they gave, which is a good one to think about racial injustice in America, of being asleep, fake woke, awake, woke, and doing the work, really applies to every important issue in life. It's a good way, everything important. In other words, am I spending enough time with my family, with my wife and my kids? Am I asleep about that? Am I fake woke? Yeah, I said hello to them at dinner time for 3.5 seconds. You know, am I really doing what it takes to do what to raise proper children? Am I doing what is necessary for learning Torah? Am I taking my Judaism properly? Am I investing in my community? There's all these areas where you go through the same spectrum. It's not limited to the issue of the hot pot topic of racial injustice. Okay, with this thing, I got 11 minutes, so I'm going to cruise this. We're gonna. I'm gonna share. Just shoot a little share screen. Just show you guys here a little sheet. So this week's parsha. This is called Chukat, and the first two words Zot Chukat HaTorah. I want to focus on this word. It talks about the famous mitzvah, which you guys have somewhat heard about, the Paraduma, the red heifer, the mystery of the red heifer, which is then slaughtered, burnt, and its ashes used to purify those who are impure. And those who do the preparation, they themselves become impure. The absolute paradox. Now, but the word chok, I want to just touch this. I want to call on somebody. Who would like to read? Let's have my first reader of the night. Any volunteers? I'm going to pick somebody in 10 seconds. All right, Shira, go ahead.
I knew you were going to do that to me.
Of course.
Which one do you want me to read?
So pick up from the Rambam, pay the judgments, Mishpatim.
Okay. The judgments are those mitzvos whose motivating rationale is openly revealed and the benefit of their observance in this world is known. The prohibitions against robbery and bloodshed and honoring one's father and mother. The decrees are the mitzvos whose motivating rationales are not known.
Good. So bottom line, the Rambam differentiates. There are two buckets of mitzvot. You got mishpatim, which we call judgment, civil law, whose reasons are very obvious. You could be a third grader and know why the Torah says you cannot steal. Because you cannot have a society when everybody's stealing from each other. You know why there's a mitzvah of thou shalt not murder? Because you can have a society when you have people murdering each other. It's self-evident. Those are mishpatim whose rationale are self-evident. Then we have what we call the chukim, the mitzvot, whose mitzvot are not obvious. The Torah does not tell us the reasons why. We're all familiar with the laws of kashrut being one, the laws of the whole list of them. So I'm going to pick one small one, which you're the most familiar with, is of course shofar. Let's take shofar. Okay, yes, Shir, keep on going. Read the pasuk about the shofar.
Okay, just a quick question. For the unknown ones, would the rules of Shabbos be in there? Partly, right?
In part, yes. There's another third character called Edut, mitzvos that are there to testify. So Shabbos testifies to the creation, testifies to the Exodus. So that's known, but why do you have to do it in that kind of way? That's unknown. So there are parts of it which is unknown. Keep on going.
The first day of the seventh month shall be a sacred holiday to you when you may not do any mundane work. It shall be a day of sounding the horn.
Okay, we call that Rosh Hashanah. Yom Teruah Yelachem, the day of sounding the horn. Okay? So I asked you all a question from the plain reading of the Pasuk. Is shofar a mishpat or a chok? What do you guys say? We can put it on the chat.
It's a chok because he doesn't say why, he just says do it.
Exactly. Boom. Correct. And it's not even clear what you have to do here also. So it's just very vague. And it doesn't tell you why. Okay, we continue on. Keep on cruising. Go on. Yeah, keep on rolling.
Even though the sounding of the shofar on Rosh Hashanah is a decree of the scripture, it contains an illusion. It is as if the shofar's call is saying, wake up, you sleepy ones, from your sleep, and you who slumber, arise. Inspect your deeds, repent, remember your creator. Those who forget the truth in the vanities of time throughout the entire year, devote their energies to vanity and emptiness which will not benefit or save. Look to your souls, improve your ways and your deeds, and let every one of you abandon his evil path and thoughts.
Oh, beautiful. All right, so the Rambam says it's not obvious what it is. It's an illusion. So he says that the shofar's there is in a certain sense waking people up who are lost from the truth. That's what he's saying. Now, I want to ask you guys, this is a little bit of a hard question, but maybe somebody knows, how does the Rambam know that? Anybody have a guess? I'm down to 7 minutes, so anybody have a guess how he knows that?
How he knows that it's meant to wake us up, is that
yes.
What you're saying?
How does he know, how does Rambam know as a guess, as a remez, that shofar is designed to wake people up who are asleep from Hashem and the truth?
Makes a loud noise.
Yeah.
Okay, so, there's a lot of loud noises out. All right, I'll give you guys a hint. What happens precisely 9 days later after Rosh Hashanah?
November.
Boom. So it's very, it's kind of obvious that if we're blowing a shofar, it's to alert somebody to something, and if Yom Kippur is a day of repentance and reflection, obviously this is instrumental to that. A to B. Okay, now, here's another thing. Why isn't an illusion, a remez, the same as a reason? This is not, it says it's an illusion. What's between an illusion and a reason? Who wants a little harder question? What's between an illusion and a reason?
So I feel like an illusion is like faith-based. You're taking that leap of faith because there's no real reason. You don't necessarily see the results.
So it could an illusion means illusion means like it's hinting toward it. So you don't do you have 100% confidence that's what it is?
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you guys say, guys? What else? Who else wants to chime in here? Marvin Baum, I haven't heard you all night.
Sorry for drawing you away. So I missed a little bit of the first part, but. If you're just balloons saying you kind of think there's a connection, but you don't have the definite connection. If the reason, you know what the reason is. It's telling you what the reason is. So you kind of think that something is going in a certain direction, but you just don't know, as opposed to, no, you go in this direction, that's exactly what it meant.
Marvin, thank you so much. An illusion is that it's suggestive of it. It's an indication of it. It points to that, but you're not 100% sure. This is the Rambam's best guess.
Okay.
Not too shabby, but that's his best guess. A reason is, boom. Why do we live in a sukkah? In order to recreate that the Jews lived in a sukkah during in the desert time, to recreate that experience. Torah says it openly. No doubt about it. That's it. Now, two last questions before we call it a night. We got 4 minutes left. Here we go. How will a fake woke person understand the Rambam's illusion of the shofar? How will a fake woke person understand the Rambam's illusion of a shofar?
Maybe they would hear the shofar and be like, okay, you know, it's the new year, it's time to change, but they don't actually do any tshuva, you know, they don't really change themselves.
Right. So basically it's like, you know, they'll say, Larry put it right now. All right, we're good. Hold on. Chink, chink. Check it off the list. All right, catch it next year. Catch it same time next year.
It was worse the year before, and I mean, it's Bruce, and it shall be fine too.
Exactly. It's beautiful. Right. Now, people say, oh, shofar, it's a Judaism alarm clock. Bing. And, you know, they make it into a little bumper sticker, and they move on. It doesn't really move them at all. So, in what way is the fake woke response to shofar similar to the fake woke response to injustice?
It's like the hashtag. It's a trend. Right. It's not real work that like you'll do until the day you die. Like it's a trend.
Right.
You do it until Yom Kippur, and then you stop.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. I'll feel a pinch of guilt.
Yeah.
I'll feel a pinch of like, yeah, I should be better. I should be a little better. And then when the old shofar, the last shofar blast, calling the end of Yom Kippur, it's like the Flintstones, you know, boop, I'm out of here, rink, you know what I mean? I'm hitting, you know, I'm knocking over people to get to the free food at the Kiddush. Not that I would ever do such a thing, but I heard it was done. So bottom line is that it could be, yeah, the shofar is an important part. They won't miss it. They'll know, oh, it's an alarm clock to be better, but it's like the hashtag, you know, Black Lives Matter. It's a statement that doesn't really move the needle any kind of meaningful way for the into the person. So last question of the night, why doesn't the Torah help the sleeper by explicitly giving him or her the reason for the chukim?
Why doesn't it?
Well, that's my question. Hey, you can't take my question. That's my question to you. Why must the reason for chukim must be discovered as part of doing the work? Last question of the night.
Because doing the work means having emuna, and emuna sometimes is blind faith.
But how does that inform about why doesn't the Torah tells you for some mitzvos it gives you the reason, some mitzvos it doesn't give you the reason.
Because it's Judaism.
Okay, but our goal of the class is to explore, well, why does Judaism do that? And my hint is going back to what we mentioned before, is that we discussed that there are certain things about the issues of injustice that you only perceive when you're doing the work. Why can't the Torah just state, let's say shofar has 5 reasons. Interestingly enough, by the way, the fact, you can look it up after the class, Sajigon presents 10 possible reasons for shofar, by the way. 10. Okay? Why does the Torah not explicit? So I got 1 minute left, so I'll conclude. I'm very mocked about ending on time. So the basic idea is like this. In conclusion, because sometimes giving a direct reason, sometimes where it's an area where we have lots of resistance to, lots of challenges, is not helpful. It'll just make the person just maintain their fake wokeness. In other words, oh, the reason for this is this? Oh, I don't have to change because I don't have that problem. I don't have a problem. I don't see any racism. What do you mean privilege? I don't know why privilege. I went to school. I worked hard. I took all the. I studied. I took the SATs. I got a da-da. A medical. What do you mean? So the bottom line is that there's certain mitzvot that you have to do the work. You got to become aware. You got to learn about it. You got to explore the different possibilities. You got to struggle with them. What areas of my inner world is it trying to point to that needs real investigation? And when I'm woke to the mitzvah, I got it. It's not so simple. It's a lifetime project. And then when I'm doing the work of improvement of any area, that's when I start to see things about myself that I did not want to see. I'm not comfortable in seeing. So sometimes giving all the information up front is actually harmful to the journey. So the nature of mitzvot, so here's the secret here, guys. Chukim are areas which are areas which make us uncomfortable. And the only way we're going to be able to come clear of that is by doing a learning and exploration of self. And anybody who's experienced therapy knows what I'm talking about. It is not simple. It can be painful. But when you are successful, there is nothing better. And that's what really the mitzvot are all about. There are certain mitzvot which are self-evident, like do not steal. And there are certain mitzvot which are shrouded in mystery, which are inviting us to explore and to think about. And not be either asleep or fake woke, but really to engage in that. And that's really the nature of all the mitzvot. So really, it's a journey. And just how difficult, look, let's just use it. It has been 150 years since the end of the Civil War. America has been struggling with the issue of racial equality for 150 years as a nation. We have made progress. There's more to come. It's not so simple. It's not so easy. There's certain issues that we have, whether as a nation or as a people, which are hard, which we don't want to think about. But the Torah demands that we must think about. And we have to dedicate a balance, a certain amount of time to explore that. And that's what the Chukim are about. They're clothed with mystery because they deal with areas which we don't really want to know about. If you explore it, it may not be so comfortable always, but you will become a redeemed and actualized and fulfilled person. And that's the message of the Torah and the Chukim in general. I thank you for your time. Any last questions?
All right.
Okay, I got Brian and I got Daphne. Go ahead.
I posted the link to the Chinese laundromat case in the chat. It's really good. It's one of the great Supreme Court cases. It's really a quick read, and it tells you about how the disparate impact, how laws have a disparate impact. But then, unfortunately, later they also came out with Plessy v. Ferguson, which is a very shameful decision, which kind of created the separate but equal doctrine, which gave birth to a lot of the systemic racism we still feel the effects of today. But it's really an interesting read, and it gives you a good idea of how one decision was great, and then the other one just screwed this country over for till now.
Daphne, I will read it. Good. What else? All right. So Brian Hacken, you're in last thought of the night. We got Brian Hacken.
Just,
all right. And I got Esther. Okay, good. You're not. You give back your time to the floor. Okay, we got Esther. You have a question?
Okay. I don't really understand why it would make you uncomfortable though. Like on there, you have the red cow. Like how does thinking about that make me uncomfortable? I don't know what it's about.
No. First stage is to learn about it. But the area of why is there the laws of purity and impurity? I mean, that's a whole mystery. That's built on many. That's a chok built on many chokes. That's the hardest. It's literally the most mysterious one. But it deals with areas that gets to the issue of why is there a tomb of Atara? Why should a dead person? I do a mitzvah. I'll ask you the question like this. I go to a funeral, right? I go and I escort the casket to the cemetery, right? It's a big mitzvah. Yet I become tamei and I'm excluded from the Beit Hamikdash. That's paradoxical. I'm doing a mitzvah. I'm a good guy. They won't let me in. Why is that? I can't go then tonight. But there's a question about what are related to death, what's our relationship to death, not an area that we feel so comfortable about. What, you know, there's stuff there. I can't unpack that right now because we're in the OT. So there are other areas. We can expand upon this, you know, but this is just, I want to touch upon the important issues of today. I want to show you how it informs our weekly, the Torah portion, Chukim in general, and give us something to think about these issues. It's a hot button issue. I felt I was holding people back. I know we could have added another hour on this, but we'll continue. So I will, if I got something, let's call it, we do partial class every Tuesday night. You're welcome to join. If I got something super sexy and sizzling, I'll text you guys. And if I think you're gonna dig it, you know, you'll come join me. All right, guys, Lila Tove.
Thank you so much, Eric.
Thank you. Bye. Where does woke AF come in here?